Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Fireside Chat, presented by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society and broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law and moderator of the Fireside Chats. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of securities regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times and is on track to welcome 100,000 visitors this year. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no government funding. We thank Pfizer, Inc. for its sponsorship of the 2008 Fireside Chat season. Its support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Today's program is one in a series of Fireside Chats looking at the distinctive history and work of many of the major SEC divisions and offices. This series is a part of the Society's commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the SEC, approaching in 2009. Our Fireside Chat today looks at the SEC Division of Enforcement. I'm delighted to welcome Irving Pollack, who served as the first director of the Enforcement Division when it was formed in 1972, and later was SEC Commissioner from 1974 to 1980. He currently serves in private practice. His remarks today are solely his own and are not representative of those of the Society. He cannot, in this context, give legal or investment advice. After our broadcast, I encourage our listeners to access the treasure trove of materials on the SEC Division of Enforcement currently in the Virtual Museum and Archive, including a rare 1937 manual on enforcement, emphasizing that the SEC has been an enforcement agency since its founding, a training manual from 1972, when the Enforcement Division was being formed, oral histories interviews with former enforcement directors, including Irv, Stanley Sporkin, John Fetters, and Gary Lynch, and with former Associate Director Theodore Levine. A wonderful online program from 2003, in which then-Enforcement Director Stephen Cutler debates then-New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. And a 2002 roundtable on enforcement, also in online programs, which discusses why and how the Division of Enforcement came to be. This program is accompanied by a history of the division written by Daniel Hawk, now SEC Regional Director in Philadelphia. Today's program will join this unique collection of information. Irv, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm honored to talk with you today, not just because you were the first to lead the Division of Enforcement, but also because you have an expansive and insightful view of the SEC's enforcement work from the 1940s to the present, as an SEC staff member, a commissioner, and now as a practitioner. I also look forward to adding to our discussion today the questions shared by some of our museum visitors for this program. Irv, probably the logical starting place is at the beginning. I've read that the motives for establishing the division, that is, for breaking the enforcement function out of the other divisions, may have been more than meets the eye. Could you tell us a little bit about the founding?
Yes. Chairman Casey, who was responsible for establishing the Enforcement Division in 1972, was about to leave the commission when he did that. And I had a conversation on the last day of his sojourn at the SEC in which we discussed the basis for that decision. And he admitted that one of the primary reasons for it was to get me out of the regulation division because he felt that after he left, I would undo it by getting the commission to change the prescriptions that he had put in some of the rules. And so he said I was probably right that the market developments were going to do that, but it was too late to make any change.
Now, with that start, does that signify in any way that enforcement was either a favored or unfavored child of the commission?
Well, I think in the early days, and the enforcement, the predecessor of the Enforcement Division, was really the enforcement group in the Division of Market and Trading. And we had responsibility for the general enforcement that was principally being done in the regional offices in the early days of the commission. But in the 1960s, Chairman William Carey understood that we needed a more broadside national program for enforcement. And so he asked me to go down and become the assistant director of that division and to start a more global enforcement program. And we did, and from the special study of the securities markets in the 1960s, well, we established a broader program than in the original days of the SEC when it was all balkanized in the regional offices. And their principal problems were the bucket shops and the boiler rooms instead of some of the more clever national schemes that we were encountering in the 1960s. And so that program continued until 1972 when we had the single division in force. But we cooperated closely with the enforcement in the Corporation Finance Division and the enforcement in the Investment Management Division. And the Public Utility Holding Company Act relied on us to enforce that act.
Since its breakout, would you say that the Enforcement Division has been given the tools that it needs to do the job as you think it should be done?
Well, I think they have much improved tools over what we had in the early days. In the early days, we had only really the injunctive remedy that we could use against violators in addition to the program to refer criminal cases to the Department of Justice. What we tried to do was to use the equity powers of the court in getting greater remedies than just the injunction. And we were successful. We took the position that since the order in an injunctive case was issued by a court, the court had its full equity powers to make it really work and enforceable. And we were successful in doing that. Eventually, of course, the commission got the legislative authority to do that and increased authority to impose penalties, for example, as well. So the powers were being considerably broadened by the legislation, and the Enforcement Division has an increased number of tools that it can use in enforcing these securities laws.
Would you say that there are any tools that it's still missing?
I think one thing that might be considered is right now they can get all the information by demand from the regulatory authorities, from the regulatory entities. If it's outside of that area, they have to use either Section 21A of the Exchange Act, which permits them to ask people to file stuff under oath, or to issue subpoenas. It might be a quicker way of getting the information if they could have the authority to give a civil demand to issuers and others whose information is necessary to understand what's happening in the markets by that kind of a request, rather than having to institute formal proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Somewhat related to the question of remedies and tools, listener Richard S. Kraut of Dilworth Paxson LLP in Washington, D.C., emailed to ask, when and what was the first instance in which a consent to an order without admitting or denying the allegations was used, and how did that settlement technique come about?
I don't recall us ever having a settlement without that provision in it. And my best recollection is we probably borrowed it from the antitrust division that I think used that language in its consent decrees.
I'm curious about how the enforcement agency has interacted over the years with the other divisions. Obviously, before the division itself was created, its function was played by the other divisions. After it was split out separately, how did it get along? How did it work and play with the others?
Well, we had excellent coordination with the other divisions. Part of that was engendered by the fact that in addition to my role as assistant director of the then Division of Trading and Markets, I was also in charge of criminal reference to the Department of Justice. And so the other divisions, if they had a case that required criminal referral, would have to coordinate with us before that could be done. But more so, we were had such broad experience in the enforcement area and the other divisions had a combined role of regulation and enforcement in their areas. There were issues would come up, they would always consult with us. So eventually we became sort of a service entity for not only the regional offices, but also the other divisions. And we had excellent coordination with them and had many excellent cases that resulted from that because of the coordinated efforts of the various divisions.
Would you say that there was some sort of feedback loop between enforcement and the other divisions as far as setting regulatory policies were concerned?
Yes, of course, in the Division of Trading and Markets, we had our own regulatory control over all of the regulatory agencies, regulatory entities, and we would, for example, take one example of is penny stock frauds. They were a problem then as they are today, and so we tried to get a regulatory remedy and adopted the so-called Rule 15C211, which said you couldn't trade the security initially unless you had some information as to the company and had examined its filings. That partially helped. It still has a problem today because it's a very easy area for clever people to come in and abuse. So the SEC is still struggling with it, but wherever we saw items that we thought could be improved by regulation, we would try to get a rule, let's say the supervisory authority of the commission. We eventually got legislative authority as a result of that program, incorporating the principles that we tried to imply as a result of our enforcement activities.
Is it a two-way street? That is, do the divisions try, other divisions try actively to influence the policies and priorities of the enforcement division?
I would think it was a cooperative effort. I mean, we would see problems, and we weren't in competition. We were engaged in a cooperative program. The SEC had a very dedicated staff. It was not a 9-to-5 job. People who took these jobs were very talented, very bright. For example, we had two outstanding associate directors during my career, Stanley Sporkin, who Judge Sporkin now, and Gene Rotberg, who were absolutely fantastic people in their particular fields. So we had that cooperative spirit within the division where both worked very closely on problems that arose and in trying to devise not only enforcement remedies, but regulatory remedies as well.
I just mentioned priorities and policies, and you've certainly given me a good start at understanding how those things are set. But I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on the proposition that enforcement priorities might be set by the at the commission level as opposed to at the enforcement level. Would you say that it's one or the other?
In my time, it was principally set by the enforcement division as it recognized problems out there. But on occasion, if the commission saw something that it thought was a problem, they certainly would direct the enforcement division to pay attention to it. But I think in most cases, it was as a result of what the enforcement and regulatory people saw as issues that required our attention. And I think that will vary with the problems. For example, just to bring it right up to date now with this, the present issues, you saw how the commission took deliberative action to remediate some of the problems that they had now. For example, the emergency rules that they just announced in the short sale area and the other areas.
You know, I was going to ask, as a matter of fact, if you were directing enforcement right now, what do you think you'd want to be doing?
Try to act as fast as I could, as vigorous as I could, as fair as I could, and to also recognize, and I think this is important, that they can't do the job themselves. They have to rely on instilling in the regulatory area a desire to have good compliance, good supervision. I think one of the early things that we stressed was to try and get a culture of compliance in the people that we regulated. And I do think one of the very successful things that we accomplished was we sued a lot of people. We sued all of the 8 accounting firms in my day, but we got their respect. And that respect was terribly important, that even though we sued, they believed we were fair, and we handled ourselves with an understanding of the needs of the people that we regulated. So I think that's critical. If you're going to have an enforcement program, it's got to be fair, it's got to be vigorous, it's got to be aggressive. But one thing you want to do is get the respect of the people who you have principal supervision and regulatory authority over. And I think that's the most compelling principle that you want to have. You can't have a policeman in every firm or over every individual. You've got to create a culture out there that alleviates your enforcement program. And you're never going to get perfection, but if you got perfection, you wouldn't have to enforce cases against your regulatory people. It would be the outside people who weren't subject to that regulation that you would have to concentrate on. But perfection is something you always try to achieve, even though it's impossible.
As far as the number of players who've been accused of some sort of culpability, as far as current events are concerned, would you say that one group, or you'd be more interested in holding one group than another accountable?
No.
As director of enforcement?
I don't think so. I think that you'll find it spread out. You take the present situation, which is probably a good example. I guess you could put blame among a lot of people, but remember the basic cause of this was the industry themselves, the banking people and the investment houses that engaged in leverage that was just unconscionable and which they should have learned a long time ago, had risks that they could not control, and they're now paying the price for it. So I think if you're trying to assess blame, it has to go back to the marketplace and the people who participate in it. If the market worked perfectly, you wouldn't have any problems. But people who believe in this are deluding themselves. Unless you have good regulation, good supervision, and good enforcement, you're not going to accomplish your task. You have 3 parts, really, as I see it, to the overall program. You have disclosure, and the commission has the corporate regulation division. You've got regulation, you've got a Department of Trading and Markets, you have enforcement. If you have, you can have the best statute, best regulations, the best disclosure in the world, but if they're not enforced so that the people have to obey them, your system's not going to work. And I think the present situation has demonstrated that in spades. The failure of the regulatory people to control the abuses that were occurring in the market have led to this present crisis.
You mentioned before that you were interested in a culture of compliance, and I think I've also read in one of the transcripts, one of the other programs, some discussion of targeting gatekeepers as far as bringing about that culture of compliance. Are there lessons for us today, perhaps with respect to rating agencies or SROs?
Yes, you have people who grant access to the market. We call them access people. You have the people who regulated entities, you have the lawyers, you have the accountants, and as Judge Sporkin pointed out in the Lincoln Savings case, when he became a judge, he asked the question, where were the lawyers and the accountants when this program was being done? And then you have corrupt lawyers and accountants. And the best example of that, as I can remember, is back in the 1960s. We had an accountant and a lawyer who were corrupt and were making a promotion out there. We indicted them for their conduct, went to the Court of Appeals, and it's opinion language that's just prosaic and terrific in the duties of a lawyer and accountant in the present climate. And I can't paraphrase, I'll have to paraphrase the language, but Judge Franley said, lawyers and accountants with their certificates and opinions can do more damage than the ordinary criminal with a crowbar. And then said, lawyers and accountants who come from an ancient profession should well know that they cannot commit a fraudulent act and get away with it. And moreover, they can't close their eyes conduct which they know is improper or fraudulent. So I think that it's very important that they and people in the industry know their securities, don't give access to people who are corruptly attempting to corrupt and manipulate the market. So it's essential, again, as I mentioned earlier, you can't oversee everybody and run it, but I think that the basic principle, and I think the Commission can be proud of this from its enforcement and regulatory area, was to give people who they regulated the understanding that the better culture that they had in supervising and in compliance would lead to successful business. And I saw when I left the Commission and I did work with other companies that they would put out programs that said, remember, good compliance will mean good business for us. And I think we've seen that those businesses that have been most successful and stayed out of trouble pretty much have accommodated to that principle. They're going to have cases where you have people that work for you that are going to be bad, and you have to try to discover them before they do too much damage and get rid of them. But if you have that culture, I think that's critical to preventing crises as we've had today.
That tells me quite a bit about allocation of resources and reasons for allocating them in one direction or another. I've always been curious about whether it was likely to be an enforcement strategy to go after institutions to, you know, catch the biggest players, or whether it might be an effective strategy to go after individuals and send the signal that even the very small fish can't get away.
I think you have to have both. But I think it's a mistake only to go after individuals when you have entities that are corrupt. You're not going to stop that. For example, if we had sued every individual accountant and not brought an action against the firms themselves, it would be a part of business. Don't worry about it. The individuals will get hit, but the company goes on and does its usual activities without any kind of correction. So I think you want to impress on companies that they have a responsibility of complying with the law, just as you're going to sue individuals who engage in that. And sometimes you have to go after individuals who are on the periphery because you've sued others who have consented and accepted a settlement, and you can't let others who haven't get away from that. So it's a combination of both. But I think recent events, take the Enron and WorldCom cases, which were extraordinary frauds. What resulted from that was the biggest piece of corrective legislation since the 1930s, Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And had it not been for those two cases and the enforcement in those cases, you would not have had that legislation. I can tell you that from my personal knowledge in talking with the people who were drafting that legislation.
Do you think that there are any cases that enforcement traditionally has avoided, either because of political pressure or because subject matter is just too complex and technical to make a real public impact, or has it been fairly even-handed?
In my experience, no. I didn't find any cases that were too complicated for us to act. One of the great geniuses of somebody like Stan Sporkin was to look at a very complicated case and bring it down to simplistic terms. And in any complicated case, you're going to be able, whether it's a manipulation or an ordinary fraud, to simplify it so that people can understand it. And that's a technique that you must have if you're prosecuting cases or you're defending, is to make them simply and explainable enough so that people can understand the evil in it if you're guilty and the innocence if you are not guilty.
Because few things could have been more complicated than some of the Enron wrongdoings, and the message nonetheless was conveyed. And so I see what you're saying there.
Yes, I think that people can try and complicate them. They did in the early days by creating holding companies that they figured that if they made them complex enough, the states couldn't regulate them because they wouldn't understand them. Eventually, they were self-destructive, of course, in the 1930s. but despite the attempt to make them as complicated as they can. And on the other side, you see it today. The derivative market was gained great prominence by making them as complicated as they could so that the regulators couldn't understand them. And they've self-destructed now as well, because if you do that, you're going to create instruments that are not transparent. People who buy them, and including some people who should know better, will get stuck with them, and eventually you're going to have ruin, and there's no way out of it. I think that's demonstrated by, let's take the credit default instruments now. I've heard two figures. One was $46 trillion. The other one was $60.2 trillion. If you get into those amounts, you know following the money, there's something wrong with it. And my own view is people can have complicated schemes, but you have very talented people on the other side in the SEC, very bright people, dedicated. And if they apply themselves, they can get to the bottom of it. I don't recall any case that we couldn't eventually determine. It might take us a little longer than it would in an ordinary case, but we were able to get to the bottom of all of the big cases that came to our attention.
Do you recall any instances in which someone on the outside, that is other than the people who were being investigated, might have tried to throw you off the scent or distract you, so to speak, that it is, have political forces ever been brought to bear on the enforcement division that you can recall?
No, I think in our time, the political people understood that it was a death knell for them to interfere in any case that we had, except for one congressman who tried to reduce the budget of the SEC because of a case that the SEC brought against some client of his or some constituent of his. But aside from that, I think we had an excellent relationship. The congressional people respected the job that we were doing, and those who were aware of the danger of interfering in a fraud case would stay away from it. Occasionally you might get a staff member who might call you and try to discuss it with you, and normally what you would say to him, you better go back and tell your boss that this is not something that he should have any interest in. And if you take the Lincoln savings case, you remember that five senators got in trouble in trying to interfere with the regulation there. So I think political people, if they are bright and smart, stay away from that kind of thing. Now, of course, we had scandals in the Nixon administration, and there, as a result of an investigation we were doing of a big con man named Vesco, we ran into a payment of $175,000 or $150,000 that was unusual, and we traced it out, and it got back to Attorney General Mitchell and Stans in the Nixon administration. And when we got the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office to end run the Department of Justice and indict them, we lost that case because of testimony that one of our people had to give after he had initially perjured himself, but eventually they were convicted of it. So it's very important that congressional people and other political people realize the dangers of engaging in that kind of conduct.
You touched on this a bit before, but again, interested in seeing if you could amplify a little bit. Would you say that enforcement sometimes has actual legislative objectives, that it might choose to bring particular cases to highlight particular problems, hoping that either there will be an SEC regulatory response or a congressional response?
You always try, when you're trying to get either legislation or regulation improvements, to bring what I call a thalidomide case. And sometimes they'll fall into your laps. Enron and WorldCom are special examples of that. They come along, and not very frequently, but you concentrate on those kinds of cases which will illustrate some misconduct which is so egregious that it gets the attention of people outside who come forward and say, we got to do something about this. And I can't think of a better example than Sarbanes-Oxley. because that really, that legislation never would have passed in ordinary times had it not been for those cases. And so you see them in different degrees of importance that will happen. But let's go back to the insider trading cases. When we bought the first case, Texas Gulf Sulfur, and was not successful in the district court, it was overturned in the Court of Appeals, and we won that case. But even after we won that case, I had to go around the country to answer all of these people, from the economists on to former Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas, saying we were ruining the markets because it was much more efficient to get that inside information into the markets early on. And yet we heard some of that more recently, but I don't think we're going to hear it much more again, that the markets will take care of it themselves. And so that those cases eventually brought on very severe legislative remedies now, where you get triple remedies in some cases for insider trading, and where you've imposed a duty on companies themselves to make sure that they have procedures in place to try and avoid that from happening. So that's another case where legislation followed enforcement cases, despite great clamors that we were ruining the markets by going after insiders. Seems silly today, but those arguments were made back then. Kay, you even see them today.
I think that I've also seen some speculation that enforcement had a profound effect in shaping the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Would you agree with that?
No question about that. And that can be singularly ascribed to one person, and that was Judge Sporkin, who together with Senator Proxmire were responsible for that legislation. There wasn't a fervor at the commission for that legislation, at least among some of the people. But as a result of the 500 cases that came forward after one case was brought on bribery, Judge Sporkin, who happened to be a CPA, recognized that that couldn't have occurred without phoning up the books and records. So when he received the call from Senator Proxmire on what could be done to help the SEC in addressing this, he said you need books and records and internal control provisions. Well, Proxmire took that, but he added on the bribery provisions. And in recent years, we've seen an increase in the activity in that area. The SEC has become more aggressive. Department of Justice has become very aggressive in that area. And the evil in the bribery, taking it away from just the foreign bribery, is if you have bribery locally or anywhere else, and people are able to do that with the consent of higher-ups, what happens is everybody starts to feel he deserves a piece of that pot, and the result is they start to embezzle on their own. So you frequently find that you have bribery and then embezzlement, or you have embezzlement and then you have bribery. They work in symbiotic relationships.
The effect of culture again.
Yes.
And this brings me to a question contributed by John Reed Stark, Chief of Internet Enforcement at the SEC. I take it that there was a sort of an amnesty feature at the time of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Do you think that that was useful, and is there a lesson to be taken from that that might be applicable today?
Yes, absolutely. What happened there was, as a result of Judge Sporkin's actions in suing some of the people, turned out that a spread of this had gone on in the whole field. So as I mentioned earlier, there were about some 500 cases where you could have brought actions. Well, it's impossible for any agency to do a job like that. So what he and Alan Levinson, who was then the enforcement head of Corporation Finance Division, director of that division, in concert with Chairman Garrett, who recognized we had this problem that couldn't be solved by suits alone, asked them to come up with a program. And so they came up with a program which said if you came forward and you gave the full disclosure of what had gone on, that they would consider that and not sue you as a result of your violations. And so as a result of that, you had a lot of settlements that no action had to be brought, and they were given complete amnesty. Now, that kind of approach was used elsewhere, too. We would have broker dealers who, after we had brought actions and had respect for our enforcement or regulatory actions, would come forward and say, look, we have this problem. We're looking into it. Well, is that okay? You know, what can we do? How can we solve it? And we would say, go ahead and do that, and then report back to us. And if we find you've done a good job, we may not be able to give you absolution, but we certainly will take that into account in any remedy that we take. And as a result of that, the independent investigations that you now see being done really started back then, where people would do that. And I remember getting a call from somebody, we did this erroneous short sale, or we did something there. And I'd say, all right, don't lose your calm. Do what you have to do to correct it, and we'll come in and tell us if you're finally done, and if it's appropriate, we'll do that. And then you can take it. It was a crisis in the back office, you remember, in late 1960s, where we had the same problem. We had a lot of the brokers that couldn't control their books and records, and because of the interrelationships and the brokers trading with each other, it affected each of the brokers who traded, whether they were doing it properly or not. And so there, too, I remember one case, a company that now is in the news, Lehman, who had a terrific problem there and called in by Stan Sporkin and said, look, we have this problem. Unless you go out there and hire 50 accountants and put your books and records in order, we're going to bring a proceeding to suspend you from doing business. And, you know, go ahead and do it. They did it, and then we settled the case after that. So it's a situation that's not unusual, and if you're doing it properly, you want to reward people who are trying to do the right thing. That's tremendously important. If people come in and say to you, we have a problem, we're addressing it, and we just wanted you to know about it, fine. When they're done, there's no necessity of bringing an action unless there's something you want to get money back or something that they're not going to do voluntarily. But look, they do it voluntarily, that's fine. What you're trying to accomplish, again, gets back to our very initial discussion on culture. I think the most accomplished thing you can do, whether you're in regulation or you're in enforcement, is to get people to be their own self-regulators and have them understand that in the long run, they will be much better off and they'll be much better successful. And I have seen that in my own experience, not only when I was at the commission, but in more recent years when I've done outside work in helping people improve their compliance regimes.
That's sort of an uplifting message, given current events. Do you think that there is still sort of time for some of the miscreants involved in the current disasters to come forward and take care of things?
Well, I think if they're smart, they will try to do it. Litigation is tremendously expensive, and more expensive today than it's ever been because of the Internet. Just to produce emails is tremendously expensive in an investigation. I know of a case where a company spent over $10 million in just producing emails, eventually was able to get out of the matter. But it was very expensive. So if you have a problem, you're going to spend money trying to find out why it occurred and how it occurred. But if you can come forward and convince the regulatory authority that you've done a good job in correcting it and it was not evil so that somebody should go to jail, then I think you've accomplished your job well. Not necessarily to fight every case. Some people think, you know, the first reaction is to fight every case. I think you've got to evaluate it when you're representing somebody on the outside and determine what would be the best choice for them in terms of the overall thing you're trying to accomplish in representing them. And frequently it'll be to go in and say, we're not interested in fighting this. We're not arguing with you. We just want some time. We're going to do our own inquiry, and we'll come back and report to you what we find. And hopefully when we show you what we've done, that you'll feel that we've done enough, that no further action will be necessary. And I have found in the cases where I was appointed, let's say after I left the commission, as an independent counsel to go and review somebody who would engage in conduct that was violative, one of the most rewarding things is to go in there and find the people who were trying to do the right job after these occurrences, sometimes because they came in later than the people who did the improper acts, and you rebuild that business. I've done it in exchanges with individual securities houses. So I think a understandable, competent regulatory and enforcement program should reward those who are trying to do the right thing. It should punish those or get remedial action for those who don't get the message.
Would you say that a prospective defendant's attitude toward doing the right thing, making a clean breast of things, is much affected by its choice of counsel? That is, I'm sure you've had an opportunity to view a number of people from both sides of the fence, and does personality matter?
You're going to get different views. There are some people who will believe that litigation is always the proper thing and you shouldn't try to do anything else. You could get those. You get other people who will feel that that's the last thing to do and to do it. And I think it depends on the experience of what people have had, so that some of them will get turned off if they try to come in and do it in a fair way and they get clobbered by somebody who isn't a reasonable person who doesn't understand what prosecution should be like and what you're trying to achieve. But I would think, speaking generally of the bar, I think most people understand that you have to make a choice where you see the case. If you think it's a defensible case, the commission may be overboard on something, then you have to really make a determination. Do I litigate this, or do I settle it even though I think that maybe the commission is overreaching a little bit? You get some of that. In my own thing, is with respect to an individual, if I am professionally convinced that he didn't do something wrong and he's being unfairly targeted, then I would put all my effort into trying to defend him. And I've had such cases in the past where I was successful. But that's the unusual one. Normally, it's more of, is it worthwhile to engage in this? Is there sufficient basis for the regulatory agency's conduct that it's better to go in and try and reach an agreeable settlement and void all the costs? Because besides the particular course of investigation, very disruptive to have a person trying to do a business and at the same time responding to these inquiries. And more recently, you've seen the Department of Justice become much more active in cases than they would be years ago. In my early days, I had to go to the Southern District of New York and convince them that they should bring a Securities Act case because it was too complicated or too extensive and time-consuming for them to do it. But once we brought some of those cases and they saw the tremendous rewards they were getting for it in terms of publicity and commendation, then they would come and say, set up a fraud section for us because we want to go after that. And that actually occurred with respect to the commission's program.
Oh, that's interesting. I was going to ask something about how the criminal referral process worked, and you've given me part of the answer there, that not only were you making referrals and lobbying for them to bring actions, but now there might be some sort of affirmative interest in doing it even without being asked. Is that right?
Yes. In the early days, there was a reluctance because the U.S. Attorney Office, for example, in the Southern District of New York, had part-time lawyers, not full-time lawyers. And so they didn't want to get involved in a big case because they would like to try a case and then go out and do the private practice. And also, the Department of Justice here in Washington had little control over the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York because of the political situation. They were pretty much independent. And so I first went to the Department of Justice and said, you know, can you get these cases that we've sent up there prosecuted? And they said, we have little control over them. And so I said, do you have any objection if I go up there and try and do that myself. They said, be our guest, go up there.
Did they pay for your ticket?
But I did that, and I spent considerable number of years up there trying to convince them to do it. And eventually I was able to convince them to bring one case. And even though they were unsuccessful in it, it was clearly a manipulation that the guy was acquitted on. They were interested. And then I gave them a second one, and they got tremendous publicity after a conviction. And from that time on, it was easy sailing. All that they wanted was our cooperation and sending people in to help them because they didn't have the expertise. And as an aside, there was really no white-collar defense bar in the early period. It was, they did not have the competent people you now have out there. So the SEC was principally the cause for the development of a white-collar defense bar, and the Department of Justice relied on us in the SEC. When U.S. attorneys had problems in appellate briefs or something, they would refer them to us to get help in drafting those briefs. So we had an excellent symbiotic relationship with the Department of Justice, which helped us get a very successful program. So in the early days, we were very careful to try and give the U.S. attorney the best cases we could have with the best proof so that they could be successful. And once that was established and they saw the tremendous indirect benefits they got from both the publicity and from the training, so that most of your bar after the people left the U.S. attorney's offices became excellent white-collar defense counsel on the outside. And so it was good. You had respectable people who were doing that, and it helped both sides to accomplish their missions.
That's very interesting. How have the relations over time been with the states and state enforcement programs?
Well, that had sort of a mixed combination. In some states, because of political influence, there was a question as to their trustworthiness, so you had to be careful. But toward the later years, the states became much more responsible. And I say now that they have their NASA group, which started back a little earlier, they have been most successful in cooperating in cases because they will get in the fraud cases, many people will go to them to complain locally before. They don't even know the SEC exists, people who are vulnerable to this. And so the states get that first indication of a fraud. So, for example, in the fraud in Prudential case, which resulted in a payout of about $1 billion in the ultimate settlement. Part of the inspiration for that case came from the states. They had a number of states that were created a task force that were looking into the limited partnership interests that were being sold to vulnerable people. Must have had 700 different limited partnerships that were sold with fraudulent representations. And it was a result of the state's pressure that finally brought that case to the top. And the SEC came in and in a cooperative effort brought actions which resulted in the settlement. The SEC sued and Prudential and resulted in this $1 billion case, which I think was the largest settlement that I can recall in that period in terms of any SEC action.
Now, something I've picked up from some of your comments is that a lot of the job of the Enforcement Division is necessarily responsive. If there's a crisis or there's wrongdoing or the states will point out that something has occurred. But I'm also interested in finding out whether the Enforcement Division tends to have its own long-term plans. That is it simply a question of playing whack-a-mole when a problem comes up, or is there a 5-year, 10-year plan?
I don't think there's a 5-year, 10-year plan, but there is a plan to address things that you see are endemic. There is a tendency in the business, if somebody is making money in X, and it may not be completely kosher, for others to copycat it. and I mentioned the Prudential case, where they were making a lot of money selling these limited partnership interests. After the Prudential was successful, some of the other wirehouses also got into that game. So after the Prudential case was finished, the SEC went after some of those other brokers and brought actions against one or two of them for the same thing. So it's important that you concentrate on activities that are endemic, that spread throughout the industry. And if you take it right up to the present time, you see it in the leveraging that occurred. It's almost inconceivable that having had a big leverage case back in 2002 with long-term credit capital management, where you had some of the top so-called geniuses running a operation where they thought they had solved all of the downside risks and leveraged up to 40-50%, eventually had to be rescued by the street. And so if you look at that and compare it to today, you say to yourself, didn't people learn in 2002 that leverage is a dangerous thing? It can work both ways. You can make profit on it when you're in something that works out well, but you can get murdered if you're over leveraged when it goes down. And that's what I think you've seen in the present crisis. That was a principal cause of the debacle that we're now trying to work ourselves out of.
I think you're going to encounter substantial agreement on that point, at least on this side of the table. Something that I spoke with some guests about recently had to do with the regional office setup and the ebb and flow of regionalization of the SEC. Has that had much of an effect on the enforcement function?
Well, and as I said, in the early days, the regional offices were really the principal enforcers. And then, of course, when the problems became more national, you had the program that Chairman Kerry foresaw as needing additional remedial action by the SEC. And I think today what you have is so much going on that you need a strong regional presence. You need a strong national presence so that the regional offices can handle cases that are principally more localized than some national thing like, let's say, Enron or WorldCom. And they are like the cop on the beat. They are very instrumental in not only dealing with cases that are restricted to their areas, but even cases that may spread nationally, with cooperating in a task force within the SEC to take action against it, because you'll have it spread across the whole country and the necessity of going after people in various regions. So it should be a symbiotic relationship between the home office and the regional office. Occasionally you will get some jealousy because people will want a case that they think is going to get a lot of publicity, and they'll say, why did you take the case away from me, you know, and that sort of thing. But I don't think that that's a real problem. I think in most cases they have more to do than they can possibly handle, so there's no debate upon who should handle it. And more you're seeing, because of the global nature of the problems, that the SEC, in attacking particular issues, will establish task forces, not only within the SEC itself, but with FINRA and the states, NASA as well. And so I think there's enough to go around for everybody to have enough to do, and the issue is to just make the most effective use of the tools and personnel that you have. And I mean, you never have enough money to do all of the things you would like to, so you've got to try and cooperate and do the best job you can. Even the Attorney General in New York, who has been very active, you'll see is cooperating with the SEC, even though he's done a lot of the things on his own.
Speaking of personnel, the Division of Enforcement has a terrific reputation for hiring very good people and for truly being a meritocracy. In your view, has it been a good place for women and minorities to work?
Yes. I think the SEC was one of the first agencies to concentrate on hiring minorities and women. In my days, I think we had the first woman attorney that was engaged in enforcement activities. The SEC also had another woman who was in charge of broker-dealer regulation. That was very good. So I think that opened it up. I think partially that was due because you had an agency that really was inspired by the Depression. And you got people in there who were dedicated to the mission. They were very inspired, and they stayed on for years because they had been through the Depression area, and I think security in part was something that they wanted, and they all believed enormously in the program that they were engaged in. They were the most dedicated people, and hours meant nothing to them. They would work day and night when they thought there was something that was not cricket and that they wanted to eliminate. So one of the great things about the agency was the consistency of their personnel that stayed for years. Just to give you one example, they had the most outstanding oil and gas engineer in the country. I could see people coming in from the outside. His name was Tell White, and consulting with Tell White on issues that they have. And somebody would say, if Tell White says it's a dry hole, it's a dry hole. We also had an outstanding mining engineer. And, of course, the director of the Corporation Finance Division in the early days was responsible for writing the Japanese securities legislation after the war. They were remarkable people, and I must tell you, when I first joined them, I looked upon them as geniuses. And a little anecdote will explain this to you. I had just gotten married, and I was looking for insurance. An insurance agent came in and said to me, "Mr. Pollack, where do you think you'll be 6 years from now?" I said, "I'm not going to be very far up from where I am now." There are geniuses in this place, I want to tell you. And boy, are they good. So the agency it had a reputation as being the best independent agency in the government in ratings that were done by the Hoover Commission and others. It was recognized as a great place to work. And the people there, I think, all were very much engaged in establishing a spirit of coordination and camaraderie. It was more like a family than it was a government organization.
In the just couple of minutes that we've got left, I was hoping that you could answer a final question contributed by John Reed Stark, and that was, which was a better job, being director of enforcement or being a commissioner?
I think they both had rewards. The enforcement job was better because you were pretty much in charge by yourself. The commission was pretty much hands-off so long as you were doing the job well. When you got to the commission, you had four other people that you had to convince of whatever your program was. But I would say I enjoyed both of them. There was more freedom down in the enforcement division than there was in the commission. But I was fortunate. The first commission I went with was absolutely fantastic. We had people on there that were incredible. We had Chairman Garrett, Al Summer, who was a very outstanding lawyer, Phil Loomis, one of the best legal minds that you have, and then a non-lawyer, John Evans, who could not have been a more personable, dedicated guy to protecting the investors than you could have had. And so we didn't always agree when we started out, but we also agreed when we got done, and if we didn't, we would dissent from the thing. So it was a tremendously competent commission, one of the great commissions that I had the opportunity to serve on.
Irv, thank you for sharing your perspectives on the work of the SEC Division of Enforcement today. It's been a privilege for me to talk with you, and I'm positive that our audience felt the same as they listened to you. You exemplify the best of the SEC's mission in ensuring fair and open markets since 1934. Today's Fireside Chat is now archived in audio format in the Virtual Museum, so you can listen again at any time. A transcript of the discussion, as well as the chat in MP3 format, will be added to the online programs section in the coming months. Again, I'd like to thank Pfizer, Inc. for its generous support for today's program. Our 2008 Fireside Chat season will conclude on Tuesday, October 21st at 3 p.m. Eastern Time with a discussion of the SEC Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations with Lori Richards, OCIE Director, and John Walsh. Please join us again on October 21st, and thank you for being with us today.
And thank you.